August is a wicked month, says Edna O'Brien. But sometimes beautiful things can happen in August. September will always be associated with 9/11 and the Twin Towers tragedy. However, the iconic World Trade Center also has an August connection, one that does not involve the horror-stricken faces and anguished gasps of early morning New York commuters. Instead, on the morning of August 7th, 1974, those on the busy Manhattan streets were stopped in their tracks as they gazed upwards at the Twin Towers skyline. Their faces were full of curiosity, which was to change to wonder and gleeful admiration over the next hour. They saw a 24-year-old Frenchman, Philippe Petit, walking on a wire cable from one of the Twin Towers to the other. He was 1,768 feet above the Manhattan streets, and he had no harness or safety equipment of any kind. Naturally, the crowd of curious onlookers grew and grew. For 45 minutes, they watched, enthralled, as Philippe walked back and forth from the north to the south tower, holding an 8-foot balancing pole. They saw him skip, dance, and sit on the wire. Those lucky office workers who watched from the upper stories reported seeing Philippe sing and even have a conversation with an interested seagull. The glorious escapade ended only when the New York Police Department sent a helicopter and warned Petit that he would be forcibly plucked from the air if he did not immediately desist from his illegal activity. And so, to rapturous applause from all who witnessed this extraordinary event, Philippe Petit completed one of the most famous walks in history. Philippe was born in August 1949 in Seine-et-Marne, France. His father was an airline pilot, and this may have been a factor in inspiring his son to be interested in looking upwards. As a child, Philippe loved to play on trees, and he often experimented by walking on low ropes from one tree to another. But as he grew, Philippe felt destined for a higher calling. He began looking at interesting buildings, such as Notre Dame Cathedral and Sydney Harbour Bridge. And in his late teens, he did, in fact, do some wire walking on those structures. These activities he would later describe as nothing when compared to his stunning Twin Towers achievement. The first remote whisper of an idea of doing something at the World Trade Center came to Philippe as he sat in a dentist's waiting room in Paris in 1968. There, Philippe read a magazine article on the yet-to-be-constructed Twin Towers. The seed had been planted, and over the coming years, Philippe became obsessed with what he himself termed le coup. A wealthy German friend provided financial support, and Philippe spent a year making preparations for le coup. He hired a helicopter and took several trips over the Twin Towers, studying the angles and layout, the wind effect in various weather situations, and other relevant information. Philippe was also now in a position to employ a team of conspirators to assist him in his daring adventure. On the eve of August 7th, 1974, Philippe and his men gained entry to the Twin Towers under the guise of carrying out an electrical project on the roof, and they made their way to the top. Some of the team were in the South Tower, while Philippe and others worked in the North Tower. When office employees went home after their day's work, Philippe and his team hid under a tarpaulin cover until the coast was clear. Using a bow and arrow type maneuver, they managed to attach the wire cable to both towers. They spent hours checking safety issues and getting the tension of the wire cable exactly as they wanted it. By 6:45 a.m., on the morning of Wednesday, August 7th, 1974, for the first and only time in their history, the Twin Towers were firmly linked together. Out from the North Tower stepped Philippe to begin one of the most famous walks of all time. In the aftermath of this extraordinary event came the inevitable court appearance, which added further excitement to the whole episode. Philippe's punishment, if you could call it that, was a judge's order to put on a free show for children in Central Park. Another interesting spin-off effect was the fact that the popularity of the Twin Towers increased greatly as a result of the enormous publicity involved. Prior to the walk, there had been less than expected demand for office space. Now, suddenly, every big company in New York wanted to have their office headquarters located at the Twin Towers. Next Wednesday, August 7th, is the 45th anniversary of Philippe Petit's stunning achievement. No doubt Philippe, now a celebrated author and public speaker, will joyfully recall and celebrate the great event. And I suspect that among the millions on the New York streets, some sharp morning commuter will cast a wistful upward glance at the Manhattan skyline in memory of Philippe and Le Coup.
Sandy was looking up at me, all set for a walk. Her furry coat the same colour as beach grass, like the dog in the musical my daughters were in that summer, Annie. I plonked down at the wall near the shops, trying to figure out what I was going to do with her. My therapist said that the universe would provide, and I was that kind of a gullible idiot to believe her. But just then, like a miracle, Tish Prendergast came along. "Oh, here's my lovely little Sandy. Who's a good doggy then?" That high voice she used when we brought Sandy to her dog training classes in Penny's car park. Not that they did any good, but still we tried. "How about kennels?" Tish asked. "Margaret Kelly is good." "We can't afford that. We're looking for a place to live ourselves." "Well, leave it with me. I'll ask around." She was back to me within the hour. And the minute we got word, my sister Emer had us in the car and heading for Ballymun. Whatever about having us to stay with her family and the new baby, there was no way she could squeeze in the dog. Walking around the flats, we met a young woman who looked like a warrior with her half-shaved head and the tattoo of a butterfly on the back of her neck. "Are you looking for the dog, woman? She's just above you there. Press 3 in the lift." When we knocked on the door, there was an outrage of barking. Sandy looked up at me, tail between her legs. But when the door opened, the dogs couldn't get to us because there was a child safety gate across the hall. The dog woman had sallow skin, hair scraped back into a tight ponytail, gypsy earrings. She told the dogs to go to bed in a quiet enough voice, but they did what she said. She nodded, gesturing for us to come in, not friendly, but not unfriendly either, just busy. There were dogs everywhere, small, medium, one big old Labrador with stiff hips. They were curled up on armchairs, on the sofa, on cushions and in baskets, lolling tongues, happy out. And there was a doggy smell, but it wasn't too bad. A bit like being at the vets, that kind of smell. Animals, but medicine as well. She pulled out a drawer, rummaging for a notebook to write down our details, and I spotted 3 bottles of rescue remedy in amongst the veterinary supplies. "Is she spayed?" "No, we meant to, but we never got around to it. I'll have to have her spayed." "How much will that cost?" "No worries. I have an arrangement with the vet." She crouched down and began to massage Sandy's ears and her neck, and then she smoothed the fur along her spine. Her hands were older than her face, and she had a turquoise ring. There were cards everywhere, all along the windowsills and the mantelpiece. Thank you cards with images of laughing dogs. This is so good of you to take her in. It's what I do. Should I ring to check on her or... No, just come back when you're ready. She took the lead from me and started edging us back towards the front door. The children were petting the dog, putting their arms around her neck, gripping onto her coat, and we had to pull them away. Don't cry now, you'll upset Sandy. Look how nice it is here. She'll have loads of friends and a better bed than at home. But I didn't want to leave either. I wanted to sit down on the couch and cuddle into the animals, and I wanted to be fed Rescue Remedy drop by drop from her hand. Outside there was a high blue sky. We smiled at everyone and they smiled back. And it wouldn't be long, I said to the girls, it wouldn't be long at all till we were back again bringing Sandy to our new home. It was easier to find a house to rent in Dublin then. And after 6 months, we found a place where the landlord took me on trust and I never failed him. On the day we came back for her, Sandy cleared the gate in the small hall and flung herself into our arms. I looked up at the dog woman. Thank you so much. But she couldn't hear me with all the barking, and besides, no words, no money, no card could ever thank her enough for what she did.
It was the summer of 1974. I was a young reporter in my first year with the Evening Herald. Every day back then, in mid-morning, the newsroom would empty once the first edition was gone. Most of the reporters went for tea or coffee. One or two headed for their first pint of the day. I was the cubbest of cub reporters, so I stayed behind. One morning, as the others left, I saw my news editor take a call. He hung up and looked around for a reporter. And there I was. Young fella, he called, go up to the Gresham Hotel. Someone says John Wayne is there. It was only 22 years since the release of The Quiet Man, the film which made John Wayne a hero and a legend in Ireland. This was pretty big news. Why did a cub reporter get the job? I suspect it was largely because the whole thing seemed unlikely. Big movie stars didn't show up in Dublin hotels and give an interview to the first reporter who asked, did they? So send the cub. At least it'll get him out of the office for a while. I strolled up to the Gresham with our photographer, the late Eamon Gilligan. We headed straight to the dining room, having been told that John Wayne was having breakfast there. And so he was. There was no security, no minders, no handlers. Nor was there any point in beating about the bush. And so I walked over and said, excuse me, Mr. Wayne. My name is Paddy Murray and I'm with the Evening Herald newspaper. I was wondering if I could have a word. He looked up and smiled. Sit down, young fella, he said, and have breakfast with me. And I did, and so did Eamon. So, I guess you're a reporter, he said. And who do you work for? The Evening Herald, I reminded him. And do you like working for them, he asked me. I told him I did, as it became clear that it was he who was interviewing me. He asked a few more questions. Did I go to the movies? What movies did I like? To which I, of course, replied, Westerns. Eventually, I got to ask him about Brannigan, the movie he was making in London. It was a part he chose, having turned down the role of Dirty Harry, subsequently taken by Clint Eastwood. He didn't know Dublin had a famous detective called Brannigan, known to one and all as Lugs. He laughed. If I'd known that, I might have called myself Lugs in the movie. We chatted about The Quiet Man and his memories of making that classic movie in the West. Ireland is the most beautiful country in the world for making films, he said. I would dearly like to make another film here. But it would have to be personal. He reminded me that his ancestors came from somewhere in County Cork. We talked too of his admiration for Richard Nixon, a fine American, he said. He had ended the Vietnam War when two other popular presidents couldn't. A man who had done nothing wrong, he said, just weeks, as it happens, before the disgraced president quit. What had him in Dublin, I wondered. He had come, he told me, to meet his good friend Lord Killannon. And when are you meeting him? I'm not, he said. Turns out he's in Zurich. So on we chatted as he tucked into two fried eggs, a half a dozen rashers, a few sausages, tea and toast. He was, it has to be said, a thorough gentleman, and made sure there was tea and toast for us too. As I stood to thank him, deadlines, you know. We could have chatted all day otherwise. He asked me where he might get a Bonnie hat and a blackthorn stick. Just up from the main door of the Gresham back then, where Toddy's bar now is, there was a souvenir shop. And so John and I, he told me he didn't mind me calling him John, walked together up O'Connell Street to the astonishment of the city's citizens. Eamon snapped away with his camera, taking photographs of the movie star and the cub reporter, as wide-eyed Dubliners looked, stared and stepped forward to shake the hand of a man who was then and is now a movie legend. And while John managed to get his souvenirs, I have none. Because I have no idea where the picture of the two of us on O'Connell Street is now. The Herald published a photograph of John Wayne surrounded by Dublin fans, but not the one of him and me together. And sadly, John never got to make another movie in Ireland. He died less than 5 years after that day we met in the Gresham. But at least I have the memory. And so if the name John Wayne ever comes up in conversation and I'm asked if I ever met him, I can reply smugly, met him? Should we have breakfast together?
My late mother-in-law was a most hospitable woman, and most of my memories of her involve sitting at her kitchen table eating delicious food while she regaled me with the comic version of rearing 9 children in Finglas in the 70s. She always looked back with fondness at her children's teenage escapades. And situations that would have reduced a lesser mortal to a bag of nerves provided her with an endless supply of entertaining stories. My husband, her 7th child, seemed to be the particular cause of much of her mirth. Even stories of his accident-prone childhood, which resulted in her regularly accompanying him to A&D, usually on the bus, always ended well. He survived falling off vehicles constructed from pram wheels and wooden crates, and cycling so fast down a hill that he crashed into a parked car. One incident in which he fell foul of the local Garda for playing curbs, a crime that involved kicking a football across the road from one curb to another, ended with a summons to the children's court. But that ended well too, because the exasperated judge dismissed the case and reprimanded the Garda for interfering in a traditional street game. Sometimes she would get my husband to start a story, and then to speed it up, she'd take over the narrative herself. One day, while we were up to our chins in chocolate cake, she asked me if my husband had ever mentioned the time he ran away to be a circus boy. Well, of course he had, but she told me again anyway. He was 16 and had just finished his intercert. He had landed a summer job as a general gopher on a building site down in Moore Street. Every morning, he took the first bus into town and spent the day digging out foundations, pushing a wheelbarrow full of rubble and carrying buckets of cement before returning home to eat his dinner, crawl up the stairs and set the alarm clock for 6 a.m. After a couple of months of this Groundhog Day lifestyle, he had saved quite a bit of money, but he was too exhausted to spend it. While the concept of a work-life balance had yet to be invented, he knew that there had to be more to life than work and sleep. So when the rumour went round the building site that Teddy Fawcett was looking for line tamers, trapeze artists and trainee clowns, the young man knew what he had to do. The following Saturday morning, he confided in his mother that he was running away to join the circus. She was tickled at the prospect of having a clown for a son, so she made him some sandwiches, and he promised he'd come back for his things if he got a job. So, all dressed up in his red and blue plaid shirt and new Levi's, our young adventurer took the train from Amiens Street to Bray and walked the promenade to find the circus. The circus people, who were probably used to lads turning up like this, told him that Mr. Fawcett was resting now and would be doing interviews later in the evening. He walked back along the promenade, squandered some coins on the slot machines, ate his sandwiches on the beach and had an ice cream cone for dessert. He decided to head back down to check if Mr. Fawcett had woken up yet, when the distant whistle of the Dublin train struck a pang of homesickness deep within him. He thought fondly of his mother and the dinner she'd be preparing, beef and onion stew and thick gravy, suet dumplings and mashed potatoes. And as it was Saturday, there would be pancakes too, dripping with lemon juice and golden syrup. He ran to the station and caught the train back to the city. his dreams of overcoming his fear of heights to hang out with trapeze girls, of putting his head in a lion's mouth, and of making children laugh as he tumbled in the sawdust, all gently fading as the train snaked the crescent of Dublin Bay. But these dreams may not have completely disappeared. Our grandchildren have somehow got the idea that in another life, their granddad did work in the circus. And I see the dreamy look in his eye when the circus posters appear round the town. So when the big top is on the race course, I'm telling you now, I lock the door at night, put the keys under my pillow and hide circus boy's shoes. I'm not taking any chances.
The Opera du Rhin is regarded by many as second only in France to the Opera de Paris. Located in the medieval heart of the ancient city of Strasbourg, its elegant neoclassical opera house is listed as a national monument. This beautiful building is to be found at the eastern end of the Place Broglie. Behind its dramatic colonnade, the interior is decorated in a Baroque fashion with gaily painted ceiling, gilded pilasters, and swarms of delightful putti or cherubs playing a variety of musical instruments. It never fails to delight the visitor. As one of many expatriate music lovers living and working in Strasbourg, I formed part of a small group of seven colleagues that each year made up a subscription for the upcoming year's performances of ballet and opera. The key moment of our annual operatic activities was the summit meeting held in somebody's apartment, where our choice of forthcoming events was agreed. Even the Vienna Congress itself could not have been more challenging. But following meaningful exchanges of view and some frank and open discussion, our talks would bear fruit and we would achieve a mutually satisfactory agreement. The odd glass of wine may well have contributed to the invariably satisfactory conclusion. One morning in 2003, one of our group, my Maltese friend and colleague Vanni Bonello, visited me in my office. He told me that he had just talked on the telephone to a young fellow countryman who was coming to Strasbourg to sing the lead role of Rodolfo in Puccini's La Bohème, which was one of our chosen operas. "Why don't we invite him to join us for supper afterwards?" he suggested. I, and all the others when they heard, were delighted that we would have the chance to actually meet one of our visiting stars. An invitation was proffered and was duly accepted. On the night of the performance, we were all thrilled by the beautiful lyrical singing of this young man who was clearly on the brink of a wonderful career. We also looked forward to meeting him, and we picked for supper one of our favourite local restaurants in Strasbourg, located a mere minute's walk from the Opera House in Place Broglie. This little restaurant was one of a traditional kind, which in Alsace are called Windstubs. These are small, cosy restaurants, usually serving the typical regional dishes associated with Alsace, such as choucroute, tarte de l'oignon and back-off. Most also serve something more French brasserie style, such as roast chicken, pâté de foie gras and so on. There is something for everyone in these charming, typically wood-panelled little family restaurants decorated with gaily coloured tablecloths and Uncle Hansi pictures on the walls. The one we chose was Le Clou on Rue du Chaudron, the Street of the Cauldron. Located close to the great cathedral of Notre-Dame de Strasbourg, Le Clou is the very epitome of the traditional Windstub. It is still thriving today and no doubt will continue to do so well into the future. After the opera, six of us made our way over to Le Clou. After a short while, my friend Vanni, who had waited behind for our guest, brought him along to the restaurant. It was obvious that there were other opera goers in the little Windstub as discreet signals of recognition and congratulation emanated from all around us. Joseph was a fine, burly-looking young man of 25 years with a quiet and modest demeanour. He told us about his early years and how he started singing in his church choir. He had a brother whose voice he loved, he said, but who sang pop. For some reason, he told us, his brother could not make the operatic sound. This mystified but intrigued us. It was some time before Vanni got our guest to admit that just days before he had signed a contract with Decca. We all knew what this meant. Joseph Kalecka had arrived. During the course of our supper, it emerged that that very day was our Turkish colleague's birthday, and the previous week had been Vanni's birthday. This called for action, and our patron's approval having been granted, sing-songs by the locals were regular occurrences in Le Clou, we all launched ourselves into a glorious rendition of Happy Birthday. Although he could have drowned out an army with his great voice, Joseph kept himself in check, and a hearty but harmonious performance was delivered by our impromptu chorus. It was an unforgettable experience, and over the course of the following years, I managed to create a few opportunities when I was able to drop into the conversation, as casually as possible, of course, that once I had sung with Joseph Kalecka.
What a young Fermanagh woman said as she toiled with praties and fire. One day I'll walk out of here, and I'll walk and I'll walk until I find a ship to America, and when I land there, I'll set out again and keep on walking till I meet a man who has never heard of Boxty, and I'll marry him.
On this morning's programme, we heard An August Coup by Pat Coleman, The Dog Woman by Lanny O'Hanlon, My Friend the Duke by Paddy Murray, Circus Boy by A.M. Cousins, Singing with Joseph Kalea by John Hedigan, and What a Young Fermanagh Woman Said as She Toiled with Praties and Fire, a poem by Vincent Woods. The music was When I Get Low, I Get High by Marion Sunshine, sung by Ella Fitzgerald with the Chick Webb Orchestra. I Love My Dog by Cat Stevens. The Kerry Dance, sung by John McCormick. Candyman, sung by Donal Clancy, and that was recorded at Sunday Miscellany Live at the Theatre Royal in Waterford last autumn. And Che Gelida Manina from Puccini's La Bohème, sung by Joseph Kalea with the orchestra of the Suisse Romande, conducted by Marco Emiliato.